ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And there's never a bad time to get a Christmas gift, even if it's a couple of days after Christmas. Our final Christmas episode sees Todd Liebenau join me to discuss 1947's The Bishop's Wife.
Can't go in without a pass.
Oh, well, you see, we work here. That is, we just finished over there, now we...
All right, so you're finished. There's no one stopping you from leaving.
But you don't understand, we still have to make the trailer.
Well, I'm sure you wouldn't want to stop us from telling people about a great picture like The Bishop's Wife.
Have you seen it?
Well, no, not exactly, but...
Then how do you know it's great?
Well, we had a lot of fun making it, and that's always a very good sign.
The Bishop's Wife actually owes its existence to another film, 1945's The Bells of St. Mary's. That movie, which was a sequel to 1944's Going My Way, starred Bing Crosby and Ingrid Bergman as a priest and a nun who run a Catholic school. Mega-producer Samuel Goldwyn had been given carte blanche after creating what had been called, quote, the finest movie ever made, with 1946's Oscar-winning picture The Best Years of Our Lives. And after seeing The Bells of St. Mary's, he decided he wanted to make something similar. He turned to Robert Nathan, a popular author whose book The Portrait of Jenny was at the time a bestseller, and that book would receive an adaptation in 1948. The novel followed a beleaguered bishop who received some heavenly help from an angel named Dudley. Goldwyn next turned to screenwriter Robert Sherwood, who'd recently won an Oscar for adapting the script that became The Best Years of Our Lives, and much of The Bishop's Wife actually was hoped to be Old Home Week for those who had worked on The Best Years of Our Lives. But where Sherwood knew how to capture post-World War II America, he couldn't quite blend the fantasy and the reality of this movie. It was one of many issues that would end up plaguing production. Goldwyn's desire to just recycle everyone who had worked on Best Years hit a snag when Oscar winner William Wyler turned Goldwyn down to helm this film. In his place was director William Sider, a man better known for comedies, not fantastical romantic dramas. The cast at the time also included Dana Andrews as the bishop, Teresa Wright as his wife, and David Niven as the meddling angel Dudley.
Once upon a time, there was a little boy, and he lived in a little town.
What was his name?
His name was David. He was a shepherd, and the town where he lived was called Bethlehem.
Oh, I know Bethlehem. That's where the star was.
That's right. Only David lived long before the star. Well, one night, David was out in the hills tending his sheep. He was playing the harp and singing.
Was he singing Jingle Bells?
No, Jingle Bells hadn't been written then. David was singing songs that he wrote himself. Well, suddenly an angel came down and spoke to David.
How did David know it was an angel?
He didn't know. And you know, that's the way it always is. Angels come down and put ideas into people's heads, and then people feel very proud of themselves because they think it was all their own idea.
Now, you might be saying, Kristen, that doesn't sound like any of the people you've included in the clips, and that's correct. The rushes weren't looking good, so Samuel Goldwyn was forced to clean house at huge expense. He fired William Sider, replacing him with Henry Koster, who had had more success making family features with moralistic messages. Teresa Wright was supposed to stay in the role of Julia, but the actress became pregnant, forcing Goldwyn to trade Dana Andrews to RKO for the talents of Loretta Young. It was Koster who suggested Cary Grant to replace Andrews, but Grant wasn't happy. He kept finding fault with the script before eventually suggesting that he and Niven switch roles. Though the move was for the better, Grant continued to have issues with the picture in its entirety, as well as squabbling with actress Loretta Young, who couldn't abide with the actor's need for perfection. As for Niven, he was suffering from problems that extended outside of Hollywood. He was still in mourning for his beloved wife Primmy, who had died in a freak accident during a party at Tyrone Power's house.
The world changes, but two things remain constant.
What?
Youth and beauty. Now, they're really one and the same thing.
The trouble is people grow old.
Not everybody. The only people who grow old were born old to begin with. You were born young. You'll remain that way.
Oh, I wish I could believe you.
You may.
You haven't looked at my hand once. I never know what to think of you, Dudley. I never know whether you're joking or serious.
I'm at my most serious when I'm joking.
The production itself never really improved. At a certain point, talented screenwriting duo Billy Wilder and Charles Brackett were offered $25,000 by Goldwyn to revise the script, doctoring three key scenes that needed to have a 72-hour turnaround, from Friday to Monday. The two got the scenes done with plenty of time, but couldn't claim the money due to California tax laws. The first few weeks of release were rough, with audiences assuming that the film was too religious. After a simple title change to Carrie and the Bishop's Wife, the film's box office significantly improved. Reviews for the movie were also incredibly positive, and it even secured 5 Oscar nominations for Best Director, Picture, Sound Recording, Editing, and Scoring. Even Samuel Goldwyn was astounded by how successful a film turned out. In 1995, the movie was remade with Whitney Houston and Denzel Washington as the preacher's wife, but you can hear more about that on my other podcast, Waltz and Me. When we return, Todd Liebenau joins me as we ice skate with Cary Grant in The Bishop's Wife.
You give me a book, I give you a tie. Aunt Martha has always wanted an orange squeezer. And Uncle Henry could do with a new pipe. We forget nobody, adult or child. All the stockings are filled. All that is, except one. And we have even forgotten to hang it up. A stocking for the child born in a manger. It's his birthday we're celebrating. Don't let us ever forget that.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to a very special crossover podcast episode. This is the Christmas treat. You're going to get 2 episodes by listening to 2 different podcasts. So I don't know if that's necessarily easier for you, but we are talking about 1947's The Bishop's Wife this episode. And if you want to listen to our thoughts, me and my special guest this week, we talk about 1996's remake, The Preacher's Wife, on my other podcast, Walt Sent Me, because it's a Disney movie. So if you want to get the best of both movies, got to listen to both episodes. But if you want to just hear us talk about Cary Grant, then you're in the right place. Let me introduce my guest. He's been here before when we did another holiday, but we did Halloween. You might remember him, Todd Liebenau. Todd, how are you?
Hi, it's great to be back. I like never get to podcast with you. That's a lie. That's a total lie. We're always podcasting together.
Right. Yeah. Todd and I do Walt Sent Me. Again, reminder, if you want to hear about The Preacher's Wife, going to have to listen to that episode. Todd was also here last Halloween. We did our 3-episode Frankenstein tribute. Todd's getting all the holidays.
And it was so much fun for me to expand your horizons on Frankenstein, because so many people know the first film, know The Bride of Frankenstein, they ignore Son of Frankenstein, and I was glad that you enjoyed that film as much as I do.
We are celebrating another 1947, another 70th anniversary. I know I kept saying 60th when we talked about Miracle on 34th Street, and I am terrible at math. Forgive me for that. The Bishop's Wife is directed by Henry Koster. You might know him as the helmer of delightful Family Fair, including my favorite Margaret O'Brien movie, which I keep talking about, and I've never actually done a full episode on it, The Unfinished Dance, the amazing movie where Margaret O'Brien commits manslaughter against a ballerina, feels really bad about it for the entire movie. But he also directed James Stewart's 1950 film Harvey, 1961's Flower Drum Song. Essentially, any time you felt good in life, you've probably watched a Henry Koster film. He had a lot of great films, but this is probably the Christmas film that he's best known for. It tells the story of a pastor named Henry, played by David Niven, with his David Niven-y accent, but he's at New York, who asks for some divine intervention to build a cathedral and is gifted with an angel by the name of Dudley, played by, of all people, Cary Grant. As Henry tries to navigate his crisis of faith and conscience, Dudley just really seems interested in Henry's wife, Julia, played by Loretta Young.
That's an understatement.
You had never seen this or the remake before I suggested we do this.
The Bishop's Wife is one I was definitely familiar with and I'd always heard about. It's one that I seem to remember my wife holding over my head and being like, you call yourself a movie fan and you haven't seen The Bishop's Wife? So finally got to watch it. It's a very interesting film. It's strange to think of how to sum this up in my mind, because I was like, this is a very enjoyable, sweet little film. It's also very strange.
I saw this on a whim on TCM one day, probably during Christmas time. I missed about 15, 20 minutes, and I decided, okay, I'll give it a couple minutes. I ended up watching the whole movie. I was just so compelled by the story that it tells. It helps so much that this movie has Cary Grant as the angel, because a lot of the movie is just watching Cary Grant be Cary Grant.
Yeah.
With this faith-based message about believing in God and believing in the people that are in your life and not wasting a minute of your time and not neglecting the people that love you, all of that. I think it's got a very sweet story. We'll talk again, much like with Miracle on 34th Street, there is a very heavy post-World War II message, but I think it's a bit subtler in this movie than it is in Miracle on 34th Street. There are a couple allusions to acknowledging that the war had ended, but not a whole lot. Where do we want to start? Because you mentioned that this movie is bizarre. A lot of that has to do with Henry Koster as a director. He was kind of a journeyman, born in Germany. His films do tend to espouse Americana, but through the lens of showing people at their worst.
Well, yeah.
At least their most venal. Stuff like The Unfinished Dance, released the same year. Margaret O'Brien hobbles a woman and proceeds to feel really bad about her feelings and throughout the rest of the movie. This movie, David Niven is a bishop who spends his time bemoaning his lot in life. You look at something like My Cousin Rachel in 1952, which is a movie about this needful obsession to covet something. Or The Virgin Queen, watching the Queen of England be really petty. My personal favorite, I think the film that this adheres to the most is, if anybody's seen it, Mr. Hobbs Takes a Vacation from 1962,
yeah.
Where it's a similar story about a put-upon family man who proceeds to gripe about how horrible his life is and missing the flowers for the trees.
And I got to admit, Mr. Hobbs is a movie, again, another one I had heard a lot of, and then finally got to watch it. Didn't really care for it that much.
I find Mr. Hobbs to be very funny because I'm not a big Jimmy Stewart fan. And I like Jimmy Stewart when he's playing a jerk. This movie does have my favorite Jimmy Stewart line, "Where's that albino?" If anybody's seen it, he's so mean this entire film, but it's really funny. Maybe because you don't expect Jimmy Stewart to be rude, ever. I find that one to be a fun film, but you don't really feel for the character, just like you don't feel for David Niven.
To an extent. There were a few moments where I could kind of feel for David Niven, but I mean, in the early moments of this film especially, you really get caught up in that we are watching a whole bunch of people here who are feeling so put upon, basically because they've all got their focus in the wrong places, or they're very selfish. And it's hard to necessarily relate with them, which is probably part of what makes Cary Grant's character resonate so much, because he comes across as just this lovable, happy-go-lucky every guy. I mean, I love the way that he's introduced, where he's just walking the streets and very happy to be there and watching the people at Christmas time and just taking it all in. He comes across as this everyday happy-go-lucky everyman, and he's just lovable from the start. You almost wonder, well, why does he really want to help these selfish people?
There's an element to him that's similar to when we talked about Miracle on 34th Street, to the Edmund Gwenn character. Mm-hmm. You don't get a lot of background about why he's there. And you're under the belief that angels just walk amongst us.
Right.
So Cary Grant's character isn't necessarily drawn to David Niven's Henry. He's just assigned for the day, but you're under the impression that he spends his day intervening in people's lives, whether it's stopping a baby from being hit by a car or just talking to people, escorting them across the street. There's this world building of God and his minions, for lack of a better word, are all around us. It's very prevalent. Which I appreciate a lot.
Yeah, I enjoyed that too. And if he's going to be drawn to anything in this movie, what he's drawn to is the bishop's wife, which is where the story, I think, starts to take that kind of weird turn that I talked about before. Because, you know, what I'd always heard about this was that we have this story where this angel's supposed to help out this pastor. And okay, great. But then I had also heard he starts to fall for the bishop's wife. And I'm like, wait a second, isn't that a little sacrilegious? How am I supposed to feel about that?
That leads me to a question. So the crux of the movie is about Henry finding the wherewithal to get this cathedral built under his terms, because he spends most of the movie trying to please a woman, Mrs. Hamilton, played by Gladys Cooper, who you might remember as the little old lady in an episode of The Twilight Zone. I'm trying to remember. Is it the one with Robert Redford? I think it might be.
Oh, let me throw in here. One thing I thought was very funny was that her character's name was Mrs. Hamilton, because my brain automatically went to Margaret Hamilton, the Wicked Witch of the West. And I was like, this character is very Wicked Witch of the West-ish.
We're going to talk about some of the character performers that are in here, because there's a great amount of character actors. He's trying to please her. She wants to build this edifice to her husband. He wants to build something that will be reverent to God. Much of the movie is him trying to do that at the expense of his wife and his daughter. His daughter, by the way, is played by Carolyn Grimes, who you might know as Zuzu from the other Christmas movie, It's a Wonderful Life. More connections to that movie, even though we're not talking about it this Christmas. I like what this movie does, even though I don't like how it does it. So the movie's called The Bishop's Wife, but the bishop's wife doesn't really have a lot of say in this movie. This isn't Julia's film. This is Henry and Dudley arguing about Henry's lack of faith and the fact that Cary Grant's making moves on his wife. But you never really get much of Julia's desires or her sense of agency, even though she is the central character.
Except that she wants a hat. That's
She wants a hat. Henry Koster really likes hats. Because again, throwing out the unfinished dance, there is actually a plot point in that movie that involves blackmail, small children, and a hat. I'm not kidding. Plot point of that movie. Although, do we think that Dudley is the villain in that instance? Because he's going against God.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself wondering, how exactly does he think he's helping things here? Because he's trying to get the pastor to pay more attention to his family and not let other things consume him. All right, that's all well and good, but the way that he goes about doing that is essentially to make the pastor jealous because he thinks he's making the moves on his wife.
They're essentially both trying to pee on the same tree. Yeah. That's the best way I can explain it. That's exactly right. Dudley is thinking if he makes Henry jealous enough that Henry will want to spend time with his wife. At the same time, though, I think what the movie does well, something akin to, I'm going to throw out a really pretentious foreign film, something like, I think it's Wings of Desire, this concept of if you are a heavenly object, where does your individuality come from, especially when you fall in love? Dudley, you are under the belief that he's been doing this for a long time. There's no individuality to his character, at least aside from the fact that he looks like Cary Grant. You're under the belief that he has not lived life on Earth other than to serve.
Yeah.
And so when he meets Loretta Young's character for the first time, she's inspired feelings in him that make him question whether he wants to go back to heaven. I wanted more of that story because Cary Grant is so good in it.
Yeah, you get the impression like this is the first time that he's ever really gotten to experience some of the things that the humans he's been serving all these years experience. And that leads to some very sweet moments of the film. I mean, you have that whole ice skating sequence, which is probably one of the more memorable aspects of the movie. And
that Cary Grant mask.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That stunt double in the Cary Grant mask.
It takes about a minute or so for you to adjust to it. And then you just give in and go, okay, yeah, I'm going to look past that weird mask and go, this is a pretty sweet sequence. Some fun ice skating choreography. But moments like that just become so happy and joyous. They're part of what make this film somewhat irresistible on a certain level.
And Cary Grant, in 1947, he had gone back to comedy after doing some serious dramas. He had done None But the Lonely Heart. He played Cole Porter in Night and Day, which he played Cole Porter in a movie in 1946. And trust me when I say it's not accurate. Unless you want to talk about art imitating life and Cary Grant playing Cole Porter. And then in 1946, he did Notorious, where he plays a character who is just like the biggest, biggest jerk in the entire history of film. I'm sorry. I love it, but I hate his character. And so 1947, he's playing these Cary Grant types, I think is the best way. So he was in The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer, which is a very cute movie. If you think this movie's weird, wait till you watch that movie where he dates Shirley Temple because a judge demands it. But here, he's playing a Cary Grant type. But he's playing a Cary Grant type that is compelling people to see the best in humanity.
Mm-hmm.
you look at him and you wish every man was like Cary Grant. You wish every woman could get a Cary Grant. Cary Grant is essentially all that is good in the world in 1947, which works out just fine. And you bring up the ice skating scene, which I think is very cute. The scene that always does it for me, there's a couple moments that I think are worth discussing. I don't think Cary Grant gets a lot of credit for how good of an actor he could be. It's really easy to see him as Cary Grant, this guy who just, with a wink and a smile, could seduce you. There's a moment where he's telling the story of David to Henry's little girl. And it's this really, I mean, of course, everybody comes out of the various rooms to listen to this story.
Yeah.
And it's not because it's Cary Grant telling the story. It's because it's Dudley telling the story so well and with such passion and interest, like he was there. And he might have been there.
Yeah, you kind of believe that he was. It's a lovable sequence and also has a little bit of an awkward undercurrent to it, because you're watching David Niven there standing off to the side and you're going, dude, you should be telling this story.
What? And Dudley asks him, you know this, why don't you tell her? And he just brushes it off. We're going to come back to Cary Grant, but how do we feel about David Niven? David Niven is an actor that is hit or miss for a lot of people. He's fine in certain movies where he plays an arrogant, pompous, usually drunken sod. If you watch something like The Moon is Blue, he's really fun. Whereas in this, he's just uptight. That diminishes any good performance.
At the same time, I think that you have an interesting moment where that finally starts to break down when we get to the end of the film. And he's got that scene with the professor, and he's coming to realization of how he has been ignoring his family and his true responsibilities. And you see that pompous attitude start to break down. So in some ways it works, but you do wish that Niven's character felt a bit more human.
Because so much of the movie is just him being flippant about everything. Dudley tries to direct him, and even his wife tries to direct him at a certain point. You haven't said anything about my hat. And he's just, oh, yeah, it's nice. I don't really care. So when he has that epiphany, I wanted that epiphany to come more from a moment with his wife and not, you know, the professor. Even though I love Monty Woolley, I just was thinking, this moment would be a bit more cathartic if you were with the person that you know you should be with.
Exactly.
I'm not a big Loretta Young fan. I know, I've watched both pre-codes and post-codes. I don't really care for her.
This is interesting because I've had a limited number of films that I've seen her in. Most of them have been pre-codes. And with that, I've been quite intrigued from her. You know, things like Employee's Entrance and Hatchet Man, things like that. You know, I've kind of gone, oh, she's very interesting. And then we got to this film and I'm going, this is not the same person I saw in those movies.
Loretta Young is one of those actresses that is a very intriguing person because she made these pre-code movies and is probably best known mostly to people in the 50s and 60s as this very conservative, staunch example of the staid 1950s as the 1960s and the hippie movement would come up. She was looked down on for being this uptight relic of conservative values. I've seen a couple of her movies, stuff like Platinum Blonde, the aforementioned Midnight Mary. Loretta Young always seemed to be an actress that was always torn between two ridiculously good-looking men. So if anybody's seen the movie she made after this movie, which is Rachel and the Stranger, that's a delightful film where she is a mail-order bride bought by William Holden and then is wooed by William Holden's best friend, who's Robert Mitchum. And the whole movie, you're just like, there is no right answer to this question. I can't pick. Why would you make me? In here, she's got that very sweet smile. She's very innocent.
Yeah.
And I think that she's got this purity to her, and I think that's what makes the character attractive. But I like how much this movie, and I'm sure the movie didn't know it at the time, but a lot of this movie is the treatment of the female gaze. Because a lot of the film is just watching her look at Cary Grant like he is the last cupcake on the tray.
Yeah.
And I am all for that. Cary Grant plays up how he is this perfect embodiment of masculinity. He's good with their kid. He can ice skate. There's that palm reading scene that is just super hot. And they're in a restaurant and he's telling her all these amazing things about herself. And I think that that's really important. I brought up how Maureen O'Hara in Miracle on 34th Street was reminding women and men about all this time that women have been working outside the home, and you're going to get these hard, bitter women. But at the same time, Julia as a character is reminding men coming home from war, hey, your women missed you and they loved you, and you need to be appreciative, or else there's another soldier down the street that would probably take her. I'm a fan of their relationship. As much as the movie isn't about Julia, the scenes that are about her are really focused on her desire more than anything else. This movie was essentially filmed by William Sider. He started directing this, and then the studio saw the rushes, hated it, threw everything out, fired William Sider, brought in Henry Koster, and then redid everything that they had filmed at a great expense. But initially, Cary Grant was going to play the bishop.
Yeah.
And David Niven had played Dudley. How do we feel about...
I read that too, and I just can't picture it. It seems so foreign a concept. Part of what really makes the whole idea that you've got this questionable relationship happening between the angel and the bishop's wife is that the angel is Cary Grant. I mean, nothing against David Niven, but he's much more tailor-made for the part he plays here.
And I think that were you to change the two, Cary Grant was very upset that he had to play the Dudley character. I think he realized it was just him playing himself. If you had the David Niven character playing Dudley, you'd get a more uptight, by-the-numbers type of figure. I think of someone like Buck Henry in Heaven Can Wait, this pencil pusher type of character that acts as more of a nag than anything else. I think this works. And it helps that David Niven had played a character that dealt with life and death when he did A Matter of Life and Death, the Powell and Pressburger film, which is a beautiful movie if you've never seen it. I like their back and forth, their banter. There's not a whole lot of disbelief for most of the movie that Dudley is who he says he is. So after a certain point when Henry buys in, okay, this guy's an angel, it just becomes this odd couple situation where they start needling each other. My favorite scene is when Dudley just starts, like, rummaging through his mail like he owns the place. And Henry says, are you expecting a letter? And Dudley says, well, no, but if I did, the stamp would be worth saving. A testament to how witty the script can be.
It's interesting you're talking about David Niven's character here, and there's that underlying depression, whatever it is that all he's going through here. And you have to wonder, what more is at play here? Because the situation that we're presented with is that he's upset because he's building this cathedral, but the funds are not happening. He's got parishioners that are not living up to their promises, not giving the money they're supposed to give. It's all financial stuff. Hit on the fact that this is coming in the post-war era. And I have to wonder what else is under the surface here that we're not really delving into. What's really more the cause of the depression and all this that he's going through? Was he in the war? Is there other things that we're not aware of here? I mean, it seems like there's stuff that could have gone a bit deeper.
It's why I bring up something like Miracle on 34th Street, where we talked about how that movie is very steeped in reminding audiences that the war had ended just 2 years before. You get moments that act as reminders, whether it's a little Dutch girl talking about how she's an orphan. The implication is that her parents have died. This movie, I think, is subtler. You get the fact that Henry wants to build this cathedral not as a monument or a statue to a fallen, an imagined hero, but as proof of God. And I think that that says a lot right there, that in the wake of this war, when you were getting all these monuments and a lot of people questioning what it all meant, he wants to build this edifice that is a place where people can come together and say prayers and hope that this doesn't happen again. He doesn't want to make this statue to one man. Because after the war, you would see a significant uptick in monuments to individuals. And so that's my thing. I also think that the movie's message is very timely to post-World War II, the emphasis of not living to work, that people had spent so much time working for the war, and now that it's over, it's time to go back and appreciate your family, appreciate Christmas. If you're watching Miracle on 34th Street, the reminder that you should buy your kids presents. This is reminding you to spend time. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Yeah. You should appreciate what you have now.
One of the great manifestations of that, I think, is in the taxi driver character, where they just encounter this guy. He's driving him around town, hardworking, working class guy, and he ends up a part of their adventure. And he straps on some skates, and he's out there having fun, and it's the best time he's had in years.
It's James Gleason, by the way, which I thought was really funny. The most overt reference to post-World War II is Dudley says, I think it's him and Julia talking about Europe, and he says that he's recently spent a lot of time in Paris and the concept of rebuilding Paris post-World War II. It's a throwaway line. It's not noticeable post now in 2017. You're not going to know what he meant, but for audiences in 1947, that's a really serious moment, which is necessary. I mentioned really briefly William Sider had cast this movie and then had everybody recast after. Julia was originally played by Teresa Wright, and they wanted to bring her back, but she got pregnant, and they couldn't put her back in the movie, so Loretta Young was kind of a last-minute replacement. Teresa Wright was the it girl of World War II movies. She was in Mrs. Miniver, and she played in The Best Years of Our Lives. This would have been a really good three-peat for her, a trio of titles, much like Loretta Young. Teresa Wright always played Salt of the Earth type of women. She's very beautiful, but she's very sweet and clean and pious and pretty. It would have been great to see her in this type of movie. She was also in Pride of the Yankees, too. She always played really supportive wives. I would have liked her a little bit better. I'm sorry. I'm not a Loretta Young fan. I'm sorry. I did want to ask how you thought about the religious component, because I always tend to praise 1940s movies for how they deal with religion. They're non-denominational. And even though this movie is about Henry building a church, and it's obvious that he's an Episcopal minister, it's not heavy-handed. There's no smiting at the end of this. There's no overabundance of it's obvious that it's Catholic, Christian, God. It's just God. In this case, it's open to interpretation. It's like the Force, to throw a Star Wars term out there.
The religious angle of this is actually much more subtle than it is when we get to the remake, which we'll talk about on the other podcast. The main place that it kind of comes to play is in a few moments, like we talked about when they tell the story of David, which the way he tells it is not completely biblical, but whatever. It's mainly the end sequence where Henry is delivering the sermon. It's a great closing moment. I don't know that it's really a sequence that depends on you having any kind of a religious outlook. It's just one of those that makes the heart swell. And in a Christmas movie, that's something you want there, right?
I like that the movie is focused more on he's an angel who is just doing good works. He's not preaching to David Niven's character about you need to pray and say Hail Mary and if anything, I think the fact that Dudley has human qualities, that he falls in love with Julia, helps to avoid this heavy-handed God and his apostles type of thing. Although that's not to say that even in movies that are about religion, I think of something like The Song of Bernadette, which is another movie I love, even though that is heavily steeped in like Catholic teaching, it still never feels ham-fisted. It never feels like it's preaching some sort of message. They actually retitled this in certain instances to Carrie and the Bishop's
Wife. Yes.
Because they didn't want people to think it was religious.
Well, and that, I think, is also playing up what we were talking about, of the appeal of Cary Grant earlier. It's not come and see this sweet story about an angel. It's just, it's Cary Grant. I mean, come on, guys.
I do want to throw out that the Christmas tree scene where he makes the Christmas tree is probably my favorite moment of the entire film. Oh, yeah. This movie is the embodiment of sweet, which I think really works in its favor. Even though it can be this very dour, this one man trying to do this Sisyphean task of creating this cathedral, it doesn't take itself too seriously.
I almost want to say a little bit of a quirky side to it. It plays out in some of the supporting players. You mentioned James Gleason as the taxi driver, the professor, Monty Woolley. We haven't mentioned Elsa Lanchester. I mean, come on.
Yes. Monty Woolley plays the professor. He opens this movie. He meets Dudley first and then just disappears. Maybe he was filming The Man Who Came to Dinner. I don't really know. James Gleason plays Sylvester, the cab driver that they invite to go ice skating with them. I do love Elsa Lanchester in this movie. She's not annoying to me like Una O'Connor is, but I think Elsa Lanchester is so sweet. She's always this Daffy Maid type of character.
She reminded me of the housekeepers in another movie that she is in, not playing the housekeepers, Mary Poppins.
It's fun to watch her play a maid in this and then watch her play a maid in something like Witness for the Prosecution with her real life husband, Charles Lawton, where it's just them griping to each other for the whole movie. And you're like, oh, they love each other. She's adorable. I feel like I'm underselling this movie, especially considering the episodes, the two previous ones we did on Miracle on 34th Street, Christmas in Connecticut, were a bit longer. This movie is such fun. It's a very sweet, heartwarming film, and it's Cary Grant at his Cary Grantiest, if that's a word. He's charming, he's romantic, he looks good. I just love him to bits. If you didn't already love Cary Grant, you're gonna love him even more in this. It's a bit too good for the people that he's trying to inspire. David Niven and Loretta Young are fine, but they are not the reason to watch this movie at all.
Cary Grant is ultimately what makes it work.
You couldn't do this with a lesser attractive actor or a more attractive actor. This would not work with Tyrone Power. You need somebody who's, like, approachable. This wouldn't have worked with anybody else. This definitely would not have worked with Robert Mitchum. Maybe next year we'll do the Robert Mitchum Christmas movie, because that's another weird one.
I'm almost a little scared to think about Robert Mitchum as an angel. Much different approach to whipping Henry into shape. I thought it was very sweet. Like I say, I think Cary Grant is really the main reason to watch this. I mean, there's certain things about this that, got to admit, some modern viewers may have trouble warming up to. I mean, it's a slow, quiet movie, but it is rewarding in a lot of ways. And I think a lot of that comes down to just the extreme likability of Cary Grant and his portrayal in this film. So I am glad that I finally got around to checking this one out.
Well, listeners, you can send me your thoughts on The Bishop's Wife. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I will read them on the next episode. If you want to hear our thoughts on The Preacher's Wife, you're going to have to go listen to our latest episode of Walt Sent Me, where we will be talking about that in honor of Christmas. Todd, I would like to thank you once again for joining me again on the podcast today to talk about this movie. Where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Well, my primary blog is called Forgotten Films, so you can find that at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also find my other podcast over there, which is called The Forgotten Filmcast. We talk all about the movies that time forgot on that show. And you can follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. And remember, if you want to hear my thoughts on The Preacher's Wife along with Todd, you can check out iTunes and search for Walt Sent Me. You can also find it a variety of other places just by Googling Walt Sent Me. You can listen to Ticklish Business, though, a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, on YouTube, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please help the podcast out by leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly with questions, comments, suggestions at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Patrons already had exclusive access, but you can now head over to Patreon and listen to my interview with Alexandra Dean, director of Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story. Next time, Ticklish Business rings in 2018 with another installment of my classic film discoveries. I hope you all have enjoyed the podcast this year. Have a safe and happy new year, and we'll talk in 2018. Till next time.